Good morning, everyone, and good afternoon. It's a pleasure for having you all attend this lecture. Again, my name is Robert Guerra, and what we hope to do over the next hour is, as it was mentioned just a few moments ago, share our experience and tell you a bit of the World Summit on the Information Society and a review of what the WISIS was, and particularly the issues that occurred with the recent summit in Tunisia. So our talk today is titled WISIS the Review, Hacking a Dictatorship. What we're going to do over the course of the next hour is, for those of you who may not know what WISIS or all these different acronyms mean, is give you a bit of context, give you an idea of what the WISIS is about. We'll go into definition of some of the key concepts that occurred, particularly the issue of multi-stakeholder. Who's involved and how they interacted with each other, some of the key issues at play, and some of the politics involved, particularly on the two issues, internet governance or who controls the internet, and the issues of financing. The specific experience that we had and the context that we found ourselves in regards to Tunisia, the repression that was experienced, the gross violations of human rights, and how some very creative individuals, very creative organizations, in a way, tried to hack the dictatorship to expose its faults, but also to push the envelope forward. We'll then talk about what's up next in regards to the World Summit on the Information Society, and then very importantly, what are some of the lessons that we learned in terms of our experience through this process. But also what are some things, some strategies that we learned perhaps from some very strange people that might be very useful in moving particular actions ahead. So I'm going to start, and what I'm going to do in terms of a background, so we have an idea of the context in terms of this UN summit, is, well, what is a UN summit, and why was this created? The United Nations, created right after the Second World War, has had a series of conferences where different countries of the world, different citizens of the world come together to discuss a very specific theme. The very first conference of the United Nations was to define the United Nations, its rules, its procedures, set up all the different structures, and this was done in San Francisco. And then it said, well, we'll have a headquarters in New York, and so on. And then they've had many meetings from there until now, but specifically in the 80s, there was a grand number of United Nations summits on human rights, on the environment, the Rio summit perhaps being the one that most people might remember. The 90s, and a whole bunch of other ones as well. And it was in this very progressive, let's bring countries, individuals, organizations together to talk about the problems of the world. That's the main context that we find ourselves in. And then some 5 years ago, in the year 2000, the countries of the world basically said, we have some great issues in front of us, and over the course of the next 15 years and 30 years going forward, let's try to achieve some reduction of HIV/AIDS and things like that. And then while they were discussing, they realized that there was one big issue that a lot of countries in the world had, and that was the issues of the digital divide. There were some very technology-rich countries, Europe, Northern America, but countries like Africa and other parts of the world who didn't. And particularly the countries in Africa said, well, this is a big issue for us, and we can't solve it ourselves. And so let's convene a United Nations conference, a United Nations summit, to discuss about this. And so that was set in motion, that was started, and the idea was to have a common vision of the information society, what some of the challenges were, and try to deal with the topics and go forward. That's the context, and we'll get into some of the specifics shortly. In terms of how this is organized, well, unlike us here, where we can have a meeting and maybe we can discuss and resolve something maybe in a day or two, for countries to decide something takes a very long time. And so the World Summit on the Information Society, in order to get to the first summit, which was in 2003, it took them 3 years to get there. And so they have to have meetings to decide who can attend the meetings. they have to have meetings as to if people can speak and for how long and who can speak and who can go into the room. That takes about 2 weeks, but it takes 6 months to decide when that meeting is going to take place. So in order to get to that very first summit, took 3 years, and to the one that was just celebrated in November, took another 2.5 years as well. So there is a lot of meetings. And the way the United Nations tries to resolve this is before they have their big meeting at the end where everyone signs, is they have preparation meetings, so also called PrepComs. And they might have a meeting around a specific topic, cybercrime, security, ubiquitous computing, volunteers, and also Europe might have a meeting, Latin America might have a meeting in Asia, and so on. So as you see in the slide, it's tons of meetings. And something that we'll talk about later is they couldn't really decide where to have one, so they decided to have two. And so the first one was in 2003, and it was basically about the grand vision, what this means, what are the principles of information society or for the world, what are some goals that we want to achieve for 2015 and beyond. And then afterwards is putting that into practice, what are specific things that we that can be done. And then in 2005, it was what was done, and what are the solutions that we can use going forward. So that's a little bit of the context. I'll now pass it over to Ralph, that will talk about, well, who was it? Who was really there?
Yeah, maybe the main difference between the other previous UN summits and this specific summit is that the other summits were mostly reactions to specific problems. Like the population growth in developing countries or environmental problems, climate change, whatever. So mostly their focus was more narrow and more trying to fix a problem in a way. And then you can start to like negotiate how many carbon dioxide each country should be able to emit and stuff like that. This summit was a bit more difficult because of course, as Robert said, to work on a problem that they saw, the digital divide, but also, as Robert also said, to define a common global vision for the information society. And that's a bit more tricky. Information society is just talking about a vision of society. That's a lot of different things to talk about. So that was one reason why they said, from the very beginning, we can't do this as governments on our own. We need to involve all the societal actors, like the business sector, who's producing most of the hardware and software and broadband connections and so on, and the civil society, the researchers in the labs, and all kinds of other actors. So that's why they, from the beginning, called it a multi-stakeholder summit. Of course, the major actors still are and were the governments. In the end, it's the 191 or two member states of the United Nations who have to agree on a summit declaration, on the summit outcomes. And if they don't agree, nobody cares if the others agree or not. It's mainly the governments have to decide in the end. They are grouped in regions and other ways. There were a couple of gangs who would always stick together and come up with joint positions and fight the other gangs. Like the European Union was one gang, you could call them. The G77, the grouping of the 77 most important developing countries. And then some other groups, like the like-minded group, they call themselves, and so on. The summit was run by the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, who also was interested to get a bit away from the old telephone world and frequencies world and so on, and get more involved in the internet world, which they hadn't been before. And then the other actors were officially called observers. That's all the other UN agencies, United Nations Development Agency, or UNESCO, all kinds of other UN agencies, but also other international organizations like the Council of Europe and so on. And then the business sector was represented as official observers. They were mostly coordinated through the International Chamber of Commerce. And civil society, that's us, so to speak, everybody else, everybody who's not government or business sector or international organization. And that was a hell of a lot of different people, as you can imagine. It was a couple of ton of activists, like professional workers who work on grassroots level, who do tele centers in developing countries or run blogs, or people who run Wikipedia, like things like that, people from the Free Software Foundation and so on. But also activists from totally different backgrounds, like who worked on environmental issues, on human rights, on totally different things. And it was, in a way, hard to come up with a joint language, so to speak. And the interesting thing was the interaction between these different groups of actors. The ITU the whole time called it a new kind of summit because of this multi-stakeholder approach, because everybody should be able to at least participate a bit. So, as I said, the governments in the end were the ones who could decide on the summit outcomes, but we had some rights, and they went further than in previous summits. We could, A, observe most of the meetings, sit there and record them, and even distribute them, stream them or whatever, though most of the meetings were streamed by the ITU themselves. We had some rights to even speak in the official negotiations, which was sometimes really helpful. We could also submit written input, so if the governments were drafting a chapter of the summit declaration on privacy and internet security or something, cybersecurity, and we thought, probably they started drafting a paragraph on cybersecurity, and then we said, oh, you're forgetting about privacy here, we should add at least a sentence on privacy, and then we could submit language to and suggest to, that it comes into the declaration, and sometimes we succeeded there also. And we could organize parallel events, which were often well attended, even by government people. And of course, once you are there and you hang out at these preparatory conferences and in the conference centers in Geneva and elsewhere, you of course meet a lot of people and talk to them in the hallways and have drinks with them afterwards and so on. What was a bit difficult, they more or less were very open to listening to us when they regarded us as experts, you know, when we could really tell these government bureaucrats what TCP/IP is, or, you know, how the domain name system really works and stuff like that. But once we started to act not just as experts, but as citizens, so to speak, who have specific political goals and interests that might contradict their own goals, it was a bit more difficult, of course, to get them to listen to us. But still, we could at least talk to them.
Okay, the main question of the WSIS was who controls the internet? It's a debate which wasn't the goal at the beginning. It's a debate about ICANN or ITU, how we learned 10 minutes before. The ITU is the International Telecommunication Union, and it's an UN organization for the telecommunication sector and doing standardization and such things. Yeah, and in the beginning of the WSIS, they were talking about bridging the digital gap, and after some months, a lot of countries put a new agenda or a new topic on the agenda, the internet governance stuff. And in the first summit 2 years before in Geneva, there was a big question, ITU or ICANN, who controls the internet? And going back in history, the ICANN is a non-profit organization based in California, and this non-profit organization runs the internet, or the it controls the core resources of the internet. And it's not only a non-profit organization based in California, this non-profit organization is being controlled by the U.S. Economy Minister, or what is the name? Department of Commerce. So, you see, you can imagine there are a lot of countries in the world who don't like a non-profit organization running the internet, which is controlled by the by a U.S. government. And the work of ICANN is controlling the core resources like the DNS root server A system, debating about new top level domains like .xxx or other stuff. But it's a lot of more debate in ICANN. It's about internationalized domain names, capacity building, security, privacy. There's a big scope which ICANN has. And they tried to do some more democracy in ICANN some years before. So most of you know Andy Müller-Magoon went into the board, and after 2 years they thought it's not a good idea. And yeah, now we have we still have an ICANN which is controlled by the US government. And next. And we had several groups at the WSIS who wanted to change it. First of all, the US thought, oh, we don't have to change anything. It's a good running system. We have the control about everything. And so we don't need to debate about it. But there have been the group of the like-minded countries. That were countries like Pakistan, China, Egypt, Brazil, lots of countries from developing nations, and they preferred another model. They wanted to let the ITU control the internet. So because the ITU is an UN agency, every country can send delegates or diplomats to the ITU, and then they can debate how to control the core resources like they always have done without the United States. International Telecommunication Union, UN Organization for Standardization of Telecommunication. Yeah, it's existing. It's a very big building in Geneva and very huge organization.
It's even older than the United Nations. It started as the International Postal or some telegraph union like more than 100 years ago.
They did the standardization for the telegraph system and mail system and such stuff. So that were the two big groups. On the one side, the industrial countries preferring the some kind multi-stakeholder approaching system ICANN. On the other side, the like-minded group, if the governments or they wanted that governance control the core resources. And in the first WSIS in Geneva, the only question by journalists was ITU or ICANN. And at this time, it was not clear what they should decide on it, all the politicians and diplomats, and they have done what they always do. They founded a working group on internet governance for the next 2 years. It was a multi-stakeholder approach. 15 people from every stakeholder involved doing a big report at the end. And the report came out half a year ago. And yeah, it was still the same problem, ITU or ICANN, no real solution. And the European Union thought about, oh, we have to do a compromise to get a decision at the end. And they thought about, oh, we need a new cooperation model, who's controlling the internet core resources, and they went out at the last PrepCom 3 months ago in Geneva with this new cooperation model, and that was a big problem because the United States didn't really like it, that their coalition partners of the European Union thought about, they're can be other positions than our friends or at the other side of the Atlantic think about. And the United States started a very huge diplomacy and press campaign in the last 3 months. I think most of you have read it on every newspaper. The UN wants to control the internet and lots of stuff like this. At the outcome, nothing has changed. They debated around 3 or 4 years. The USA still controls ICANN. A new thing is that there shall be a global internet governance forum, what the European Union proposed. So it's a forum which has a multi-stakeholder approach and shall debate these discussions in the future. So no solution up to now, but we have a new forum and we can debate on the global level the ICANN question again and again and again. Yeah, something else to ICANN.
Yeah. Well, some people say it was still a success that they were able to install and agree on this global internet governance forum as like a permanent talk shop on internet governance related matters. I mean, some could say, okay, you've been discussing this for the last 4 or 5 years, and now all these NGO jet set people, the summit is over, they still want to meet their friends and colleagues, so they set up a new talk shop. But from what I've heard, and Robert has been there, from the last ICANN meeting after the summit, that was like, what, 2 weeks ago or something in Vancouver, it already was, you could feel some impact. The ICANN people at least try to be much more open and much more receptive to what activists, for example, and the general public think about how to run the internet. And one interesting thing about this Internet Governance Forum is also that's one outcome of the whole multi-stakeholder approach. It was originally invented, this whole idea, by civil society, by some of our colleagues. And because this process gave us at least a few chances to really suggest stuff and make proposals, in the end, all the governments of the world agreed on an idea that we originally had. I think that's also something to keep in mind.
I can try. It's a very good question. The thing is, originally it was the U.S. government that controlled it was actually an individual, Postel, who controlled the DNS. He's the one who managed the DNS. And as the internet was growing and it became a resource, it was an academic network that was really run by the U.S. government. And eventually, it found its way to the U.S. Department of Commerce. And I think it was Gore, during the Clinton administration, said, the government should not really be controlling this. There should be a third party, an independent organization that tries to do this. And they knew that could not happen right away. So they set up a nonprofit, an independent organization, and they said, you can't control it all at once, but let's do it over time. Let's slowly give you some of the abilities to do this. So they signed agreements that said over 5-10 years, you'll be doing these things. And the idea was so that a government or a group of governments could not basically control the resources. And so the thing with ICANN controlling it, the issue why some countries have a problem with that is that traditionally, international resources are controlled by countries. And this is not a country that controls the internet. And so it's a core, for example, countries that don't like pornography have to now spend all this money to censor. And if they just control the internet, the domain names wouldn't even appear in their country. Or they have to actually obtain the top-level domain name for their country because it's actually controlled by someone else. And so it's all these issues that traditionally they've realized that this is a core resource and they want to exert their power. And that it's actually not a country that's controlling it, and it's not at the United Nations. The way ICANN is set up is countries can complain, but there's an ICANN board who can say, oh, it's good, we won't do that. And so that's the fight, in a sense, and in a really short summary, in that a structure was created that governments can't control, or not as much as they would want.
I think what you have to keep in mind is that we're talking about diplomats here. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they understand what they're talking about in this field. So we had a lot of discussions, of course, with the German government people, and some of them also thought and publicly said, if the US government wants to take off to take the .de or .eu domain offline, they can do it like within 12 hours and we're going to be fucked, you know, all .de domains will be offline. Of course, that's not the way it works. And if you talk to the root server providers, most of them say, well, if we get a directive from the US government to take .de offline, we just won't do it. And many of them are not located in the US, so it probably would still be there. But still, there is something about this. It's understandable that big countries like Brazil, China, South Africa, and so on, just don't like the idea that a global resource, a global public good, so to speak, is controlled by one government. They want to have something to say.
Is there a documentation about such things happened in the past from the ICANN? I mean, it's important because you can use it as an argument to take the power from them.
So this was discussed. So the concern that countries had that, oh my God, there's this organization that can take us offline. And so one of the things that was raised is, well, the French opposed the Iraq war. Some people were saying, well, you know, the U.S. government could have said, okay, we'll just take you off the internet. But the thing is, in the negotiations, even the countries that were opposed to the United States position always said that even though the U.S. has this power, they've not exercised the power. And so it's not a department of the U.S. government, and the ability for it to control has actually been less. But there, the only incidents, I think, that I've read where there's been some issue has been with Iraq. That when the war started, the top-level domain name for Iraq was actually controlled by two individuals in Texas. And because it wasn't controlled by the government in Iraq, they basically said, well, there's a war going on, and these people in Iraq are actually in a prison, and so we should actually give it to someone else. So I think that's the only time, I think, that I can remember that something like that has happened.
Yeah, the other thing...
And the reason why not, because if it happens, then that gives the argument to countries to say, you're not doing your job as you should, we should take this power away. So they've been very responsible in that regard. And so, from my point of view, the argument is true that they control, but they've not exercised, you know, they haven't taken people and countries offline.
But still, the issue is you have to trust the U.S. government to that they won't misuse or abuse this special position they have. And a lot of governments just don't trust the U.S. government anymore. But I think we got to move forward. We can take more questions at the end, yeah? Quickly.
Sure. So in regards to monitoring ICANN, the root server administrators, are, you know, they're the ones that, you know, the main root server, if there's changes or additions, they have to replicate those changes. So they're the ones that immediately see if the U.S. government or ICANN is trying to make changes. So that gets monitored technically very quickly. And there's also many academics, there's many other countries. There are whole networks of organizations that have been following this for the last 10, maybe even 20 years before ICANN.
I think a good resource for all these discussions around ICANN is ICANNwatch.org.
Okay. And so getting back, and I think the example of kind of the discussion we were having now gets back to a point that I think Marcus made earlier, but also that countries were making at the World Summit on the Information Society, is that there was a lot of time and energy spent trying to understand how the internet works, about DNS servers, who controls it or not. But if you remember what I said earlier, the original idea on the World Summit on the Information Society was to bridge the digital divide. And so some people say that, well, this is really good that we've talked about, you know, who controls the internet. It took resources, and it was just a convenient way for countries to not talk about the real issue at hand. And so the issue at hand was the digital divide. And so if you don't have resources, if you don't have telephone lines, if you need to put in satellite stations, you need resources, you need experts. You have countries in the world that have had civil war that the one thing that they do have is mobile phone networks because the warlords need to talk to each other. But it doesn't really help the citizens. And once they recover, they need a way to generate an economy. And so, you know, a lot of these countries in Africa, Asia, and South America, they basically said, you know, we need resources, we need experts, we need money, and we can't do it alone because we pay so much money in debt. You know, we just need the help. And when the WISA started, and one has to remember the context, it was before the dot-com bubble burst. And so people in the United Nations, probably not the ones at the WISA, aren't good economists, and they didn't see the bubble coming. And they basically said, there's all these tech companies, there's all this products being sold, and it's generating so much money, and the riches are there. This is the perfect time to do a summit on this, because we'll be able to just, you know, have companies just donate things to us, and there's just so much money, they'll just be able to give us things. Well, before, what happened is that bubble burst. And so we found ourselves in a situation that countries still had this need. They wanted to use technology to increase the ability of their citizens to be productive lives, to give them new things to be able to do, also for people to be wealthy as well. One has to be conscious that, you know, the wealth isn't distributed well in countries, but they saw that as an opportunity. And the problem was, you then get into a discussion is, you know, the country said, we want new money. We want countries, Germany, the EU, to give us more than just the money to rebuild after the tsunami. We actually want computers in our schools. But we can't afford them, but we want them. And so, what are some of the issues that were there? Is that the African country said, well, everyone always talks, you know, they have a concept of solidarity, of helping each other. And they said, well, let's create a fund, a pool of money that countries can contribute to, or you can get some money, and then that kind of helps all of us. And so it was a very kind of visionary, very idealistic of, you know, let's create a fund. And some of these people had studied other economic models, and they said, well, many years previously, there had been something called the Tobin tax, which is of all the financial transactions, you tax a certain percentage and you use that for development. They said, well, and this is, you know, if there's so many products being sold in rich countries, in Europe, in North America, why don't we take and add a tax to that? And all that money that's generated goes to help poor countries. So for a lot of people, it's like, oh, it's not a bad idea. You know, that's a way to be solidarity. The problem is countries like the U.S., are really opposed to paying taxes. And other countries said, well, you can generate all this thing with taxes, but then you give it to a country, and then does it go into a bank account in Switzerland, or does it actually help people? And so is it issues of corruption? Is there other things? And so they didn't really like the idea of taxes because they just wanted more information around it. And so that whole idea of being solidarity through adding a price to things didn't work out. And you know, the rich countries, a lot of the businesses said it's just market forces that should prevail. Countries should just allow foreign companies to take over telecommunications and things, and that will help things. Trade liberalization is the panacea that will work for everything. And then civil society, you know, not governments, not business, said, you know, this is like water. I mean, the internet today is like the water of yesterday and of today. This is something that needs to be accessible by everyone. It should be treated as that. And there are specific models on how you do that. It shouldn't be privatized, but it should really be encouraged. And so those were some of the discussions that were there, some of the issues that we're trying to decide. So what happened as a result? And at the end, they said, oh, a fund is a really good idea, but let's make it voluntary, but no one volunteers. And so there's a fund, so if a country wants to contribute, if individuals or companies want to, they can, but it's all voluntary, so no one's obliged to. And everyone said, that's great.
The irony with the fund at the moment is they've raised like 5 million Swiss francs or something, and this money so far only came from African countries.
I'll add two things. It's just... the other thing, too, is that the organization that's doing this eats up 80% of the overhead. So it's an 80% overhead cost. So they may have five, or it may be actually more than that, but they have really nice offices. And that's the problem. Some of the countries said is, don't spend it in the offices. Actually spend it with the people. And so now the issue is, you know, you have projects like the $100 computer and other things, to trying to saying, well, you know, it's just initiatives from people that will work. And so, you know, we can get into, you know, if you, once we're done, we can get into more of the specifics, but the problem is it wasn't really solved. There's all these ideas on how things should be done, but no one's actually given any money. So there was a lot of discussions on internet governance, and at the end, there wasn't really much promised. And now, Tunisia. Does that mean? Yeah.
Maybe the last part on financing. Quickly come back to that.
Well, just two short questions.
Yeah,
to that Solidarity Fund.
Just to finish up the financing and then questions, okay?
Okay.
So, as Robert said, most of the rich governments said the market will solve everything, just open up your markets in developing countries for our products and our companies, and that's it. The Africans had Digital Solidarity Fund, and they already had set it up before the summit took place, so the summit just could agree on, well, we take note and welcome the Digital Solidarity Fund, but we insist that it's voluntary if you want to donate. What we were still able to make sure keeps in the official summit declaration, in the official text, is that they at least acknowledge that in some situations there is a need for public financing, that in some regions or developing countries or something, where there is not yet enough demand, or especially in rural areas where just the population density is not high enough, private companies just won't invest and won't roll out broadband cables. So in these circumstances you need public funding and public investment so that markets can start to develop afterwards. And they at least also agreed on that afterwards. But that was really after heavy, heavy lobbying from our side. Okay.
Next? Okay. So the next section here is Tunisia. And so some of the questions asked by a lot of people is like, well, why the hell did you do it in Tunisia in the first place? And a lot of people asked that. And, you know, some of the things said, well, were they just in the room and they basically said, we want to do it? Or was there some particular reason why? And as I mentioned earlier, the idea had come up that there should be a World Summit on the Information Society. And so that's a good question. And the quick answer is, well, there's a bit of history behind that. And their history was that the idea to set up a World Summit on the Information Society came from Africa. And it turns out that at the time that proposal came forward, Tunisia was basically representing the African countries. And so in the name of Africa, it said, we think it's a good idea to talk about the digital divide and there should be a UN summit. And so they put it forward, and they're very a very proud nation, and they like having a lot of press, and they basically said, not only do we think that this should be done, but we should do it too. And so a lot of countries said, let's think about it. And no one really thought it was going to happen. But it worked its way through the different international agencies, it worked its way to the UN, and about 2 years later, a lot of countries realized, oh my God, it's going to happen, and it's going to happen in Tunisia. This is a terrible thing. And so what happens is said, well, where can we do it instead? And it's like, well, it's the International Telecommunications Union that put the idea forward. Ooh, they're based in Switzerland. Let Switzerland do it. Well, the problem at the time is Switzerland was not a member of the United Nations. And so Switzerland became a member of the United Nations, and then right afterwards, they held their very first summit, even though the UN is based there. But what happened is, while trying to decide this, and the Swiss saying, okay, we can do it, and people were like, okay, Switzerland is friendlier than Tunisia, the Tunisians were like, but this was supposed to be about Africa. This was supposed to be about bridging the digital divide. Switzerland should not have this. And so they started having this very heated discussion. And at the end, they couldn't come to an agreement. And so they basically said, okay, let's do it in both places. Which is a big problem, because usually one of these events takes place once, it comes up with things that they have to do, and it finishes. And so what happens is they had a first summit and then they had a second one, and this had never been done before. And so that was a very challenging thing. And so that's in a way what happened. And some people kind of ask, well, how did Tunisia really force its way to actually get it? And it was at the time, a lot of these international agencies have people that direct them. And in order to get elected, you have to have countries vote for you. And so they basically said that Tunisia promised the person who is now the director of the International Telecommunications Union the votes in order to win. And they said, well, if you support us to have the summit, we'll give you all the votes of Africa and some other countries as well. And so there was a lot of politics that's going on, not really transparent, not really open, and there's a lot of problems in regards to Tunisia. I'm not sure who's the next one. Yep.
So, Tunisia. Most of you maybe know Tunisia as a nice holiday country. Maybe you can do nice holidays there, but it's not a nice country. It's a dictatorship since 1987. And normal human rights like the freedom of assembly, the freedom of expression, or other human rights are violated every day in Tunisia. And since the dictatorship started in 1987, they have something like a Gleichschaltung. We know it from the Third Reich in Germany. All the opposition parties and groups are now in Paris, France, or they are in the prison in Tunisia, or they are not allowed to talk about politics anymore. And there's lots of torture in Tunisia, and absolutely no opposition. They have a president, President Ali. He's the president for his whole lifetime. So 2 years before, they thought, maybe we need a bit more public relations on that lifetime president, presidential, and they did a re-voting on that and asked the citizens of Tunisia, do you really want that President Ali will be a lifetime president? And 99.2% said, yes, we will. And everywhere in Tunisia, you see pictures of President Ali. It's more like a Jesus in Germany or something else. It's everywhere. We have pictures later. Next slide. So, this is President Ali, Ben Ali. You see him everywhere. You don't believe it. In every cafe, in every bar, in the supermarket, he's hanging there on different pictures. And under President Ali, you see some of the propaganda we saw everywhere too in Tunisia. It's welcome to Tunis, digital capital, land of peace, solidarity and tolerance. And they missed writing about their secret services and secret police and other stuff. You see on the right side Tunisian gongos. We call them gongos. They are officially non-governmental organizations from Tunisia who was involved in the WSIS process as civil society, like us. But if you imagine the GDR, did you know that there is an independent civil society in the GDR? It's the same like with Tunisia. And the Tunisian government sent lots of these gongos, governmental, non-governmental organizations, members to the PrepComs, to the Congress, to represent Tunisian civil society and Tunisian citizens. And they wasted a lot of resources of our works in being there and disturbing and our meetings. We had European civil society network meetings where lots of Tunisians were sitting in the last row writing everything we were talking, and it was very crazy. And so after the decision was to do the second summit in Tunis, we were talking about an alternative summit. We wanted to do an alternative summit because from civil society perspective, the whole WSIS process went into a direction we didn't really want it. We wanted to talk about human rights in the information society. We wanted to talk about access to knowledge, about all that stuff, and the diplomats and governments wanted to talk about ICANN or ITU or bridging the digital gap and stuff like that. So we thought about, let's do an alternative summit to do first solidarity with some independent Tunisian opposition groups and to discuss topics we really wanted to have a debate on the global level. And yeah, the problem started. It's not easy to organize an alternative summit in a dictatorship. We ordered, so we were a network of lots of very big human rights organizations, Amnesty International, Reporters Without Borders, Human Rights Watch, nearly everyone was involved in that. And it was not possible to get a room in Tunis. We booked hotels, very big international hotels, and it was always be dropped. Do you want to talk? It was always be cancelled for several reasons, sometimes security reasons, sometimes reconstruction, and yeah, every week there was a new cancel. And okay, so we had no room at the beginning of the summit. We had a website which was blocked by the Tunisian filtering system. We had no room, we had the whole plan, we had all the people involved, and there was a meeting at the Goethe Institute in the Monday before the summit started. Have you been there? No? Okay. Yeah, but you can better
talk about it. So what happens is they wanted to have a meeting, and because they couldn't find a space anywhere, they said, well, let's try to find a space that might offer us some protection. And the Goethe Institute, because it's related to the German government and it's related to the embassy of Germany in Tunisia, they said, well, if we have it there, then it will actually be, we'll have some diplomatic protection. The Goethe Institute can't say we're under construction because the building's already done. And so some people started to go into the building, but then what happens is, well, it's a building. And so around the building, you need to get to the building. And so then the Tunisian forces basically cordoned off the building. And they cordoned off all the streets around it. And curiously enough, is the Canadian embassy is right across the street. And so they could watch everything that was going on. And so what happened is they didn't allow people from Tunisia to enter the building, to the point that the German ambassador went to the building and basically said, I am the German ambassador. This person is with me. I happen to be a Tunisian. I want to go in. And the Tunisian authorities did not allow that. And, of course, the press was there, the press was filming this, and either the Tunisian police or otherwise took their camera, took their film away. And so because it was a diplomatic compound, it belonged to the German government, actually it was the EU, then the EU got involved. And so there were these threats back and forth to say, you know, hang on. And so what happens is, you know, no one was beaten up. I think one or two people were, but there was just a lot of armed response not to allow people in the building. And, you know, that was shocking for a lot of people that this would happen at a German cultural institution. And so the issues of freedom of expression were really highlighted at the summit itself. In one aspect, 20 kilometers away, they were saying there's freedom of expression in Tunisia, and then we were seeing the practicality that didn't work. So what happened is, well, they managed to organize an alternate summit. There was some meetings that were done. And then the whole idea was not only that people could go there and talk about issues they couldn't talk about, but also to help people collaborate, to move forward some of the issues, to actually help the Tunisians understand some of the issues and give them the space. And so as a result, what's happened is we all left. But the Tunisians basically said, we can actually work together. And so some of the progressive, independent, non-governmental people said, let's start to join forces. So afterwards, there was a joint solidarity group, and now there's this unification, and there's actually a stronger will to work together, and so that's a positive development. But getting into the issue of freedom of expression, one of the things that we found is not only were there impossibilities to access buildings because they were meetings, but the same thing is online. And so there are particular websites that might publish information about Tunisia. There was a famous blogger who had a web blog about the Tunisian president. It was mildly critical. That website was blocked. The person was in prison for 3 years. There was this whole campaign of all these international organizations. He was released a year and a half ago and then mysteriously died in March. And so there's all these issues that, and the very innocent things, even cartoons that, you know, have the president smiling the wrong way. The photograph that you just saw before, where we have the president, we have digital solidarity, and we have that. If we were to do that in Tunisia, we would be in prison and tortured. And so that tells you something. And so websites can't be accessible. For the longest time, the website of Amnesty International was not accessible in Tunisia at all. And for more information on this, the OpenNet Initiative, which is a project of several universities, have published a very descriptive report on the type of ways that the internet gets blocked in Tunisia. And for those of you who might understand some of this, or those of you who want to be creative, and we really hope that some of you will be, is there's a filtering program called Smart Filter. And from their website it says, the web you want, the control you need. And that filtering software is not only being used by Tunisia, but it's being used by over 92% of countries that filter content for their citizens. And so, you know, I'm not sure if this is a call for arms, but if people want to do something productive and you want to make sure that countries like Tunisia and others can access the website, figure out the vulnerabilities in Smart Filter. And you'll be actually helping not only the people in Tunisia, but otherwise as well. And so what's next?
Yeah. Okay, very quickly, we only have like 3 minutes left and want to take some questions. Of course, the issue is we left Tunisia a month ago, and how do we make sure all the groups and independent opposition people who worked with us still have some protection? They, of course, had some protection during the summit when the world public was watching Tunisia, but how does it work now? How do we make sure they don't get tortured after we left? So there is still close contact. A lot of our colleagues still have close links and regular exchange with the Tunisian people. And there will be a few more monitoring missions from human rights organizations who will again come to Tunisia and do reports on what's the situation after the summit. And I think the general aspect that we raised public awareness about the fact that Tunisia is not just a nice holiday country, but also a repressive regime that filters and censors and tortures, that somehow is stuck in the world public, at least in the back of their head now, and you can easily raise it again if something happens. Then, of course, there's the whole big other question of what happens after these two summits. Is it just a huge pile of paper that was produced and a huge ton of travel expenses for all these diplomats and activists? Or does it really have any impact on the real world, on the ground? So there will be some follow-up in the UN system on implementation. Implementation, of course, has to be done on the national, local, and regional level, mostly. They set some goals in the summit declarations, like they want to link every school on Earth and every public library to the internet by 2015, which to us here in Germany maybe it sounds a bit funny, but imagine, I mean, rural, small, local village libraries in Africa or elsewhere, it's really a challenge to connect all of them by 2015.
A lot, if they don't have water.
Yeah.
How will we get the internet there?
Electricity and so on. One problem with this implementation thing is that the way it's coordinated is not really coordination. It's just everybody is doing all kinds of projects, and they all can say, our project is helping to achieve the summit goals and to bridge the digital divide. And they can enter it into this big ITU database, the stock-taking database, and it's like a showcase thing of best practices. The problem then is who decides what is best practice for whom? So it's a bit, to my understanding, it's a very liberal and also market-driven approach, because it's not really, as we said, it's not really defined that what are best practices and what are the critical things and basically where the money comes from. Okay, of course, there will be a political debate following up on all the different issues, because as technology evolves, new issues will emerge and some of the old conflicts remain. There was a big fight about intellectual property and free software and stuff like that, of course, remains. It's just moving sometimes to different forums, like the World Intellectual Property Organization or the European Union level and so on. And as we said, there will be this Internet Governance Forum, which will talk about more things than just ICANN. So they will also talk about developing aspects, development policy aspects, and human rights aspects and other aspects of internet governance. So we are at the moment trying to get the privacy commissioners, the data protection commissioners, interested in that, for example. The first meeting of this forum will be later in 2006 in Athens.
I see the clock and our time is up and we had one more slide, but we can't get to it. And so our very last slide is probably the best one. Do you have more questions? Do you want to know more? You've seen us here. Here's our contact information. We've been very much involved in this over the last 4 years. It's been a very interesting process. We didn't get to talk about what strategies and what things that we learned, so we're more than happy to share that with you in a very maybe informal way over the course of the day. So again, thank you very much for your time, for your patience, for your questions, and we look forward to hearing from you. And again, thank you for attending our talk.